233AH Monticello.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Brudeau. On today's show, the Borscht Belt is burning, and the Catskills abandoned resorts keep catching fire, and no one knows why. We reported on the recent fire at the Neville Resort in Ulster County. This morning, we speak to Luke Tress, journalist at New York Jewish Week, about the state of fires in the region destroying a piece of history. Manor, Inc. is Sullivan County's award-winning youth-driven community newspaper. Their new issue is out, and the cover story is about the local immigrant experience. We speak to Editor-in-Chief Angie Hund about the challenges that Sullivan County's new arrivals face. Plus, moving toward health with Maggie Fitzpatrick, the Democrats' health and wellness columnist, and cultivate your green thumb at the 2024 Garden Day in Ulster County Saturday. It's an all-day gardening extravaganza. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel's prime minister says an unintended strike in Gaza yesterday killed seven workers for the international relief group World Central Kitchen. The group was founded by celebrity chef Jose Andres, but other relief groups that provide aid to Palestinians are expressing alarm. Arwa Mhana is a senior policy advisor for Mercy Corps.
Our staff's safety has been our biggest concern since the beginning of this conflict, and it continues to be. And last night's incident is one of the many serious attacks against the aid workers and aid convoys, and it just pinpoints the stark fact about there is no one safe in Gaza, and there is no safe place in Gaza.
The Israeli military says it will conduct a transparent investigation of the strike. World Central Kitchen has suspended aid to Gaza. It was providing meals to Palestinians, many of whom are starving. Iran is blaming Israel for a different airstrike against one of its consulates yesterday in Syria. Israel has not commented on this incident. The strike killed several people, including two Iranian generals. Oregon's governor has signed legislation that makes drug possession a crime once again. As Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports, the law also expands funding for drug treatment services.
In 2020, Oregon voters passed ballot measure 110, which decriminalized possession of small amounts of drugs, such as cocaine, fentanyl, and methamphetamine. Now Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has signed legislation that rolls that back, making drug possession a misdemeanor. The law lets drug users who come in contact with police deflect from the justice system into treatment programs. But the law also allows for a county-by-county approach, meaning treatment programs could look different or not exist at all in some parts of the state. The new criminal charge for drug possession goes into effect in September. People caught with drugs who don't or can't access treatment could face up to 180 days in custody. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
Stocks opened lower this morning on the heels of stronger-than-expected manufacturing numbers. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled about 500 points. That's more than 1% in early trading.
A survey of factory managers shows manufacturing activity expanded in March for the first time in nearly a year and a half. While the numbers suggest a long slump in manufacturing could be ending, that could complicate the Federal Reserve's effort to curb inflation. Odds that the central bank will cut interest rates in June slipped after the factory report, but remained better than 50-50. Stock in Calvin Klein's parent company is down after the company offered a gloomy forecast for the coming year, and investor enthusiasm for former President Donald Trump's social media company has faded somewhat after the company reported losing $58 million last year on revenues of just $4 million. The value of Trump's own stake fell by more than $1 billion on Monday. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Authorities in Turkey say a deadly fire has erupted at a nightclub in Istanbul. Workers were renovating the club. The mayor of Istanbul says at least 15 people have been killed and several others injured. The fire has been put out. Senegal's youngest ever president has been sworn in at an inauguration ceremony today. 44-year-old Bassirou Diomaye Faye won the Senegalese election just weeks after he was released from prison. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
Bassirou Diomaye Faye was in prison without trial for a year, accused of inciting insurrection. Now he is president following years of political tensions and protests in a country long cast as one of the most stable democracies in West Africa. Former President Macky Sall had postponed the February elections until the end of the year, but that was overturned by the courts and elections were held last month. This is Senegal's fourth democratic transfer of power since independence from French colonial rule. Faye has pledged to tackle corruption, renegotiate oil and gas contracts, and move towards ending the France-backed currency, the CFA franc. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
California officials are still assessing damage to scenic Highway 1. It's on the Pacific coast in the famous mountainous area called Big Sur. A chunk of the southbound roadway collapsed over the weekend in extremely heavy rain. It stranded a couple of thousand motorists overnight. Only one lane is being used. California officials are escorting drivers through twice daily. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. C3.AI. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Borscht Belt, of course, is the nickname for the collection of resorts and vacation bungalows across New York's Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange County that attracted crowds of Jewish visitors in the mid-20th century and left an indelible mark on American comedy, cinema, and culture. More than half a century later, almost all of the formerly prominent hotels are out of business and are derelict and dilapidated. And they've been burning down over the past 2 years, and no one knows why. Journalist Luke Tress looked into this for New York Jewish Week, and he joins us now. Luke, good morning.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Let's talk to remind folks about some of these prominent hotels that have burned down in the last few years. Last week, we were reporting on the most recent one at the Neverly Resort, but there have been others.
Yeah, so the Neverly was the most recent. This started in August of 2022 when Grossinger's caught fire. Grossinger's was one of the most prominent of the old Borscht Belt hotels. And then last summer, the Pines Resort caught fire. And then a few weeks after that, the Homowack Lodge caught fire. And it actually caught fire twice in a week. And then the Neverly caught fire last month. So, like, there have been fires at some of these hotels in the past, but the frequency of these fires is really raising eyebrows. And these are all pretty prominent hotels, or they were. Like, they're kind of old bungalows, smaller hotels scattered around. But these are some of kind of the name brand hotels from the Borscht Belt era. So it's really raising a lot of questions that all these hotels are catching fire in this short amount of time.
And these hotels, well known, very sentimental to everyone. Grossinger's, of course, inspired the film Dirty Dancing. Do investigators have any leads or any reasons why this has happened in this kind of concentrated period?
So all these fires have been investigated either by state or local police, and none have been solved yet. So in the case of Neverly, they have leads, but they haven't solved it. So the state police told me they were actually investigating the Neverly Hotel on social media. They were looking into some posts on Snapchat. And then some of the other hotels, they didn't tell me they had leads, but there were kind of suspicious activities before the fires. Like, there were campfires being set on the grounds of these hotels, or people just lighting fires in the area. And there were a lot of trespassers in these areas before the fires. So there were suspicions, but they didn't have hard leads. And they haven't arrested anybody for any of these fires yet.
So these trespassers, there's a long history of trespassers, according to state police. And of course, we mentioned some of these hotels are in a bad state, deteriorated state. It's interesting that they're investigating the Neverly one over social media and that there was some sort of chatter going on.
Yeah, so there was chatter going on, and I actually heard this not from police, but from a resident, that after, I think the Homowack fire, local residents noticed people posting that they were at the fire on social media, or at the hotel on social media, and then soon after the fire started. And so it seems like these are kind of being started by, like, maybe thrill seekers or vandals or, like, kids messing around. And it was kind of implied to me by one investigator that seems like that's what's happening. So it's probably vandalism. Other people said it might be vagrants who are staying there. Like the Neville fire, one person pointed out that it was really cold that night and people have stayed there in the past for shelter. So they might have just made a fire to keep warm and it got out of hand. So that's where these investigations are going. It looks like it's probably vandals or vagrants, but there's no evidence it's anything nefarious so far.
Something else that's popped up on social media, unfortunately, is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory called Jewish lightning. What does that mean, and why is that popping up?
So Jewish lightning, it's an anti-Semitic trope. It refers to arson for the purpose of collecting insurance money. I actually hadn't even been familiar with this before reporting this story, but it has a history, this phrase. It kind of leans into anti-Semitic tropes about Jews and money and kind of Jewish conspiracies. So after these fires, like the Borscht Belt has its Jewish history. A lot of these places were owned by Jews, although they're not anymore, a lot of them. So a lot of people, mostly on social media, are alleging that Jewish, quote unquote, Jewish lightning is starting these fires, which is like leaning into these conspiracy theories. A lot of people are also kind of implying that Hasidic Jews are involved, and they are not the owners of these properties. They have no connection to it. So just these kind of baseless conspiracy theories about Jews starting these fires. And I spoke to an investigator from the Ellenville Fire Department, one of the fire chiefs there, and he pushed back on this very strongly. He said there's zero evidence. These are being lit deliberately by owners. Jewish people should not be getting attacked for these fires, and we're going to find the people who did it, and we're going to publicize it to dispel some of these conspiracy theories.
Yeah, you spoke to George Budd, the fire department chief at the Ellenville Fire District, who, in responding to the Neville incident, denounced these conspiracies as baseless and, quote, slanderous remarks. He also told New York Jewish Week, quote, the Jewish community should not be bashed over these Borscht Belt fires. There's also, you spoke to one of the photographers, Marcia Scheinfeld, who has documented these decaying resorts about these fires, too. What did she have to say?
Yeah, so Marissa Scheinfeld, she published a book about the kind of decay of the Borscht Belt resorts. About 7 or 8 years ago, she published a book. And then she runs a project now called the Borscht Belt Historical Markers Project, which puts these big signs up in some of the towns around the Catskills commemorating the Borscht Belt history. So she's Jewish. She grew up in the area, and she said she... It's like very painful to see all these hotels getting destroyed. Like they've been abandoned for a long time, and now they're at the point where they're burning or they're getting demolished. Like she took photos for her book in the mid, like 2015, 2016, and she said half the locations she photographed are no longer standing. They've been demolished or burned or somehow destroyed. So she's saying, like, for Jewish people, this is really a big part of the Jewish American story, especially for Jews in New York. And the Borscht Belt has been decaying for a long time, and then these fires kind of feel like it's like the final nail in the coffin of these resorts. And this goes for Jewish people who remember their family ties to these resorts. And it also goes for people who live in the area. Like I spoke to Barbara Hoff, who's a business owner in Ellenville, and she told me she saw the Neville fire from her home, and she told me, like, I remember ice skating down there as a kid. I knew the family who owned it. Everybody worked at these hotels. Like either the kids were babysitting at the hotels, the adults were waiters. So these communities were very connected to these hotels in their heyday. So it's painful and sad for people to see kind of the last vestiges of these places crumbling or burning or being destroyed.
Yeah, in your article, Barbara Hoff said that the Neveli has a special place in everyone's heart. She said, quote, everyone worked everywhere, but the Neveli was really the largest. It was the hotel, the one with the TV commercials, she said. You also write something that kind of struck me and stuck out to me in your article was the line, the fires are resurfacing grief over this fading chapter in American Jewish history. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yes, I mean, there's this huge sense of loss by what the Borscht Belt was, because it was like a lot of Jewish people, it was kind of a community unto itself in the Borscht Belt. Like people from New York City, their neighborhoods would kind of go up there together. A lot of people would meet their spouses there. It was kind of like a family communal thing. And I think that's, first of all, that is missing from Jewish life today. We don't have something like that now. And it hurts people. This is where we're losing this now. And then but they're all like, at this time there are also these kind of this movement to memorialize the Borscht Belt, which I think is related to how these places are disappearing. So there's a few different efforts to memorialize it. One is Marissa's project, the Borscht Belt Historical Markers Project. And then there is the Borscht Belt Museum that is opening in Ellenville, which is near the Neveli. So the museum, it's in an old bank in the middle of town that will be a big thing to remember these places. And then there's the Borscht Belt Festival happened for the first time last year. And then there are some comedy shows that are happening soon. Because comedy was a big part of the Borscht Belt, and that's one of the biggest ways it impacted the culture. And so there's this grief, and at the same time, there's kind of a renewed interest in the Borscht Belt and these efforts to memorialize it.
Yeah, we've had Andrew Jacobs, the co-founder of the Borscht Belt Museum, on, in fact, last week to talk about some of their recovery efforts at the Neveli Hotel, because, you know, it's now hastened those efforts to recover some of those historic items and memorialize that. So I guess it is more pressing than ever to memorialize these historic hotels in this historic era.
Yeah, I think it is. Like as Marissa was saying, a lot of like her and one of her coworkers, Isaac Jeffries, they photograph these properties, and there's less and less to photograph. Also, like one thing Marissa pointed out was the Borscht Belt came about largely because of anti-Semitism. Jewish people were barred from many hotels in the U.S. They would put signs up that said like no Hebrews allowed. And then this is happening at the time when anti-Semitism is increasing in the U.S., like we're seeing with these fires. So for them, this is kind of also another impetus to memorialize this, because it's a big contribution of Jewish people to American culture. So both the anti-Semitism increasing and wanting to say that like we are part of this culture and we are part of this region. These things together really have, I think, increased the urgency a lot of these efforts to memorialize and celebrate the Borscht Belt.
Did you have a personal connection to this story that caused you to want to look into it a little bit more?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a Jewish person. I grew up in upstate New York, south of Albany. So I was in the Catskills a lot. So just personally, I feel like I'm interested and feel connected to the area. And then my family is from the city, and my grandparents would go to the Borscht Belt. It wasn't a huge part of our family history, but they would go, and they actually, like, for instance, after the Neveli fire, I was talking to my dad about it, and he recalled going there with my grandparents when he was younger. So I think like myself and a lot of Jewish people who are from New York do have this personal connection. Some people would go every summer. They had friends. It was like a big part of a lot of people's life. So yeah, like my family, like many, we did have this personal connection to the Borscht Belt. Yeah, so like this is another reason why I think Jewish people are interested in these memorialization efforts and also feel strongly about the resorts burning and being destroyed.
Luke Tress is a journalist for New York Jewish Week, a service of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. You can find his article, The Borscht Belt is Burning in the Catskills Abandoned Resorts Keep Catching Fire, at the website jta.org. Luke, thank you so much for joining us this morning and for shining light on this and how important it is to preserve this piece of history.
Yep, thanks for having me on, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Angie Hund, the editor-in-chief of Manor, Inc., the student newspaper in Sullivan County, with her cover story, The Immigrant Experience in Sullivan County. We'll talk to her live next. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Sky watchers from Mexico to Maine and beyond are gathering for a spectacular cosmic event.
There's the total eclipse of the sun right now.
Whoa! I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Robin Young. Follow the total solar eclipse across the country, live as it happens with us. It'll be a mix of celebration, reflection, history, science on this big day. Join us for live special coverage from NPR News.
Monday afternoon at 2, right here on Radio Catskill.
You are listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sullivan County's award-winning youth-driven community newspaper is Manor, Inc., and its editor-in-chief is Angie Hund. She has the cover story on the new issue that's out right now. It's The Immigrant Experience, Sullivan's New Arrivals Facing Challenges. And Angie, joining us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Are you spending time on your spring break to come in and talk to us?
Yes, I am spending time on my spring break, but it's worth it because I get to be on the radio
and
I get Dunkin' Donuts after.
There you go.
So it's a win-win.
Win-win. So this cover story, The Immigrant Experience, a lengthy article, a big article, and a big topic, I guess. What motivated you to cover this topic for the paper?
Well, Manor, Inc., we focus a lot on the Manor community, but we also wanted to start talking about issues that affect the whole county. So we're trying to take on more like serious issues because last month we did affordable housing because there's a lack of affordable housing in Sullivan County to house all the people that come in, especially low income people who can't buy land. But we're trying to tackle more serious issues. And one that came up was migration into Sullivan County, why it happens, how it affects us, like the agriculture, the economy.
And so what did you find in terms of like the influx of people coming into Sullivan County? What are you finding?
We're finding a lot of like integration in schools, a lot of like English language learners in school. There's a lot more diversity in schools. There's a lot more businesses opening up in bigger towns like Liberty and Monticello. We're seeing a lot of space being filled up, but in a positive way.
Right. And you also go into some numbers from the New York State Department of Education and about the student populations. Fallsburg Central School District's population is predominantly Hispanic and Latino, with over 350 English language learner or ELL students. Liberty's Central School District follows, with more than 30% of its students being bilingual, and 207 students in L classes, ELL. I'm not sure if it's L or ELL. And then Monticello with 178 students in ELL classes. You also spoke to Sandra Oxford, a community organizer who focuses on facilitating resources for immigrants. What did Sandra have to tell you about the experience?
First off, I love Sandra. I actually got in touch with her through a Facebook message. I was like requesting her as a friend, but she was a great resource and she knows her stuff. But she was telling us about where people find work, like where people come from, because it's not just this country, this country, this country. It's a mix of a little bit of everything, and that's why we see so much diversity in, like, restaurants and stuff. Like, I love going to Liberty. There's so much good food.
There are a lot of folks. You can see it, like, right there on the main street and in the area. A lot of those folks who've come to the area for a chance at a better life. She's telling you that they're heavily from Central America, South America, and Mexico. But there's some other folks, like Dominican folks, folks from Haiti. What else is she talking to you about the experience that they're having?
She's telling us about how, like, I think somewhere in here she talks about how, like, if you look at, like, the food industry, who really carries it, it's immigrant workers or people from other countries that come here. They're like the backbone of a lot of, like, agriculture. She tells us that. She also directed us to a lot of stats for, like, the schools.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about the schools and the youth economic group. It's in Fallsburg. You also attended one of those meetings to get an understanding of migration. What is the youth economic group?
The youth economic group is a group that meets in a church in Fallsburg. It was originally in Liberty, I was told, but it was since moved to Fallsburg. And they meet in this really cool space, and they do a lot of art stuff. They have great teachers or, like, mentors there. But basically, I went there, and it was, like, very fun. It was a group of high schoolers, high school girls, and I'm honestly very grateful that they opened up and shared their experience, because it was a very vulnerable situation, and they were all so sweet and kind.
Yeah, I would imagine that as a student and immigrant in the area, it is a difficult thing to talk about. You did get a chance to talk to folks too about some of this, and they were very vulnerable and open with you. One of the members of the group, one of the students, shared her parents' story about when her father got his residency. Can you tell folks about that?
So I wrote about it, like, two different people's experiences.
Yeah.
But we're going to, I guess you're talking about the one where it took 20 years for this girl's father to obtain residency.
Yeah.
Like, legally, it took 20 years. And the factors that really allowed him to stay was he had kids, he had a job in the country. But it's the fact that, like, it took him 20 years, like, this girl's whole life for him to, like, safely be here. And there isn't that chance that he could be taken away so easily.
And then the other person you talked to about the residency process, she talked to you about sort of an experience that is frightening, and she was scared by that when she was 8 or 9, they were kind of questioning her during this interrogation process.
Yeah, she said that they took her into a room and were like, what would you do if your parents were taken away? And I can only imagine how horrifying that could be as a young child. Like, you don't know what's going on. And to have all these people, like, question your family and question, like, the dynamic of your family and being like, this could be taken away from you, is so scary for a child or anybody.
Really?
Anybody.
Yeah, I mean, you don't know at 8 or 9. All you know is what you've experience so far. You've grown up here. This is your mom. This is your dad. You don't know about the rest of this stuff. And so it's a...
I think it's like, when you're young, you're like, what is wrong with this? Like,
yeah,
my parents didn't do anything. What's wrong? Like, they make it feel like there's something wrong with your family when there's not. It's just the way America is.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Angie Hund. She's the editor-in-chief of Manor, Inc. That is the community newspaper produced by student journalists here in Sullivan County, also award-winning. Her cover story is the immigrant experience, the local immigrant experience. And we're talking about the challenges that Sullivan County's new arrivals face, and particularly students. That youth economic group that you met with and the stories we've been talking about here, you said you had a positive experience from that, and people said that the general sense was that they're fun and they're doing well and they're adjusting well to it. Was that the sense that you got out of things?
I thought it was, like, these kids were amazing. They were, like, creative. They were driven. I think they were working on an art project when we got there, because they were, like, scribbling their names and, like, drawing and stuff while we were talking to them. But they are, like, by far the most, like, driven people I've ever met. I was like, you guys need to join Manor, Inc., because we need student reporters like you. Like, you guys are awesome.
They also talked about some of the firsthand experiences and also witnessing discrimination because of their identity that still goes on, unfortunately.
So one of the experiences was on a soccer team. The thing is, like, Sullivan County is very diverse, but it varies from school to school. So one school that's, like, highly diverse was playing against another school, and the other school that's not as diverse and, like, predominantly white was, like, screaming, like, very offensive things and telling these kids to go back to the country. And nothing was really done about it. They were told to, like, shake it off. It's fine. You can't really do anything about it. Don't let them get in your head. And honestly, that team was kicking butt. So these white kids were just jealous.
They showed them that they can kick their butts. You know, we're talking about some of the negative aspects, but there's also these positive aspects that are shared too. And also just the experience that everyone has being exposed to diversity. You also spoke to Adrienne Jensen, formerly of the county's Human Rights Commission. What did she have to share with you?
She was talking about how people are persuaded and kind of taken here in, like, large vans, and they're promised, like, a better future, like, there's going to be work, there's going to be great housing, except when they come here, it's unfortunately not that, and it's very, like, they live in sheds, there's no, like, proper plumbing, they're overworked, not really good food sources. She was telling me about that towards the end of the interview.
Yeah, and, you know, she also mentioned that food production in the U.S. depends largely on immigrant labor, and that it's the backbone of the economy in some ways. Again, you know, it's a deep article, a well-reported article. Congratulations on this effort to expose, you know, not only the students but the entire community to what these experiences are like for immigrants in our area. What did you take away from it? What did you come away learning from the reporting?
This article kind of, like, pushed me outside my comfort zone and made me realize, like, I can handle, like, bigger topics. And, like, somebody has to do it. I don't know. I was, like, really scared because I was, like, I don't want to come off, like, insensitive or write the wrong thing. But I was, like, these are great people. I got a lot of great information. It's going
to
be good.
And what do you think the students that you spoke to want folks to know? What was there a message that they wanted to impart?
A big thing was, like Sandy was telling us, we do not defend criminals. Like, criminals are people who do, like, violent things. These are not criminals. Like, I think it's trying to, like, the idea I got from it is, like, we are trying to destigmatize immigration. And it's not, like, a bad thing or, like, a federal offense or, like, it's not immoral to be an immigrant, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you sum that up at the end of your article here. Do you want to read that last paragraph? Do you have it up?
Yeah. The bottom line, the U.S. is a country of immigrants. With the exception of Native Americans, everyone at one time or another, whether voluntarily or otherwise, came here from somewhere else. In the end, it is immigration that has made the country what it is today.
Angie Hunt is the editor-in-chief of Manor, Inc., Sullivan County's award-winning youth-driven community newspaper. The April edition is out, and you can read about it, her cover story. I strongly suggest you go find it or go to manor-inc.org and support her great work and the great work of all these student journalists. Angie Hunt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, well, go get your donuts. All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, moving toward health, Maggie Fitzpatrick, the health and wellness columnist for Sullivan County Democrat, is here. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Tuesday, we're joined by Maggie Fitzpatrick. She's the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is Moving Toward Health. It's out today. And today, we're talking about simple practices and great results. Maggie, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. Simple practices, great results. It sounds very good, but...
You want a little info about it?
Well,
it's been a long morning.
Well, you said something in this opening paragraph that managing your health is similar to running a business. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so over the last 6 years or so, I have been on a business journey along with health journey. And I've noticed some similarities that I think probably extend out further than those two areas of life, too. But something I've noticed is that we tend to think that the more complicated something is, the more results we're going to get out of it. And fortunately and unfortunately, it's just not the truth. Usually, the more simple we can make something, the greater results we're going to see because of a lot of factors. But it makes us less stressed if it's more simple, right? The more complex we make something, the more factors we have to be able to navigate and control and maintain. It just makes everything more complicated, right? So as I was learning how to open up my online fitness coaching business, that was the first one that I started, I expected my mentors to hit me with a lot of complicated things that I needed to do in order to be successful. And one of the simplest, most unexpected, yet most powerful things that they encouraged us to do in the program that I was in was to start a morning routine. And I was very confused because I was like, I really don't understand what this has to do with business. But I actually learned that it has a lot to do with success in general. And it can apply to our health, it can apply to business, it can apply to, you know, anything that we're looking for. So that really threw me by surprise.
Well, we've talked about this a little bit, I think, and maybe folks know, too, when you're talking about health, fitness, you kind of think, oh, morning routine, I need to kind of do X, Y, Z for better health, whether that's how I eat or how I exercise. But then applying that to the business model kind of threw you a little bit, as you said. And at the time, you were commuting back and forth to the city, too.
Yeah. So this is where...
Which is a big routine.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That was quite the experience. That's for sure. Taking the train to Manhattan every day. But that forced me to keep this new morning routine that I was going to implement extremely simple because I already was waking up very early. I already had a very long commute and I didn't want to extend out my morning by even more, right? I was like, I need to sleep. You know, I can't be waking up that early just to add in all of these other things that I need to do in the morning, right? So when we're thinking about morning routine, it's easy to think like, oh, I need to spend an entire hour on my morning routine or something crazy. Our brain always goes to the extreme, right? Like I was saying, we think complexity leads to success, but in reality, simplicity leads to success. So I was kind of forced by these time constraints to create an extremely simple morning routine. So I chose two things that I was really interested in at the time, but hadn't been doing consistently, and that was meditation and journaling. And I committed to just like a 5-minute meditation, and I bought the 5-minute journal, which I love the 5-minute journal. If you haven't heard of it, I would highly recommend checking it out. And I committed to do that every day. And at first it was really hard. And then I absolutely loved it because I started to feel so much more calm and grounded and able to make decisions. And spending just that 10 minutes every day on myself before I gave myself to the rest of the world tremendously changed the way that I was able to show up for myself in the rest of the day.
Yeah. And it's, I love that this article is about just establishing a routine that isn't necessarily about lifting weights or going for a jog or eating the right food. It's about just having this sort of way to start your day that just helps put you in a better path for the rest of the day, whatever that is for each person.
Yeah. And it's going to look different for each person. Like I said, those two things were really interesting to me and I felt pulled to try them. And so that's why I did that. And those are two things that are still part of my day today. I go through waves of consistency and inconsistency, of course, right? But those are two things that I find, like, if I go back to them, to that simple 10 minutes, I always feel better, right? And that's going to be different for different people. Maybe you're someone who needs a little bit of creativity. Maybe you read a book in the morning. Maybe it is going for a walk outside is the thing that you do for your morning routine. Maybe it's sitting and really enjoying a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, right? Then you're just quiet. Whatever it is that feels interesting to you to spend a couple of minutes to yourself in the beginning of the day while keeping it simple is going to be that thing that is going to lead to the greatest results.
Yeah, I found that well, when we started this show back last summer, I realized, oh, there's now this structure, which is really good for me to have like this structure in the morning. But then like, what do I need in order to like get to this point where, oh, okay, well, you're on the air at 10 and then this has to happen and this has to happen. So I established this routine, which I've actually started to enjoy and now realize that I have this period of time that I need to allocate for myself. Mm-hmm. And when I have to change that morning routine, it throws me a little bit. So like next week is the fun drive starting on Monday. Donate now. and so I have to come in earlier.
Right.
But I still need that time. So I'm like, okay, I'm backing myself up here. I'm going to take this hour. I need an hour. I'll take this hour and I'm going to start, you know, here at this time of the morning instead of here. But I know that I'll feel better later because I'm not going to be rushed. I won't be, you know, feeling like I didn't get to do something. The dog will be happy. I'll get to do Wordle.
Yeah.
So those things are like part of the, you know, that make it, you know, better for the rest of the day, just from my personal experience.
Yeah, I love those examples. Thank you for sharing that. And that's great. Oh, such great awareness too, right? It creates, it's so challenging to even be able to recognize the fact that you need it and it's so beneficial to you to then be able to look forward. This is like the ultimate goal, right? To be able to look forward and say, next week my schedule changes, so I need to change the way I do my morning routine so I can take care of myself and show up better for everyone else in the rest of the day,
yeah.
Right? Because you're showing up here, you're giving all of your effort to this organization, right? And you can't do that if you don't take care of yourself. Same thing if you're a parent, if you're a teacher, whatever your job is, even if you're single, it doesn't matter. You can't show up for those around you. You can't show up for your health goals. You can't show up for your business if you're not taking a little bit of time for yourself, whether it's 10 minutes or an hour, whatever it is for you. We have to start to do those things because that's how we can be the best version of ourselves.
It's not selfish. It's not. You're doing something for yourself that will just benefit everybody later in the day.
Exactly.
But if you'd like for me to sleep in, donate now at wjffradio.org.
I like that one.
Please. But, you know, as you say in the article, simplicity leads to consistency. Consistency leads to results.
Exactly. Don't make it so complicated.
Don't make it so complicated.
Yeah.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you, NCAA tournament, how's it going for you?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So full transparency. I have not watched a single men's tournament game. I'm all women's basketball this year. Can you blame me?
Right. That's where the excitement's.
Oh, yeah. I was up until 1 a.m. watching the second game, the UConn versus USC game. Yeah. But big Iowa fan, big Caitlin Clark fan. So we're pulling for them to go all the way for
all
sure.
Right. All good. Mm-hmm. All right. Maggie Fitzpatrick. She is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her article is Moving Toward Health. Her column is Moving Toward Health. It's simple practices and great results that we've been talking about today. It's on newsstands now or at SC-Democrat online.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Sorry, I always forget. Thank you, Maggie Fitzpatrick.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, it's an all-day gardening extravaganza that's happening at Cornell Cooperative Extension in Ulster County on Saturday. We'll talk to Mark Wolf, Director of Horticulture and Environmental Stewardship at the Mountaintop Arboretum. He's giving the keynote. We'll hear from him live next. This is Radio Chatskill.
It can be hard to let your mind wander sometimes, to learn about something new, or to get fully engrossed in somebody else's story. That's where NPR comes in.
It takes a long time to create a fairy tale.
He was both a Jesuit priest and a jazz manager.
As soon as I saw the subject, I thought, oh my God, this is it.
Invest in deep, human storytelling today by giving to this station.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
Hi, I'm Bill Williams.
Join me for the Kingfisher Project Tuesday on the Local Edition, when my guest will be Spencer Norris, an investigative reporter for New York Focus. His latest piece is, In These State Prisons, Addiction Treatment is Out of Reach. That's the Kingfisher Project, Tuesday evening at 6, only on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Master Gardeners of Cornell Cooperative Extension, Ulster County, are presenting an all-day gardening extravaganza on Saturday, featuring 16 classes taught by the Master Gardener volunteers. And the keynote address will be delivered by Mark Wolf, Director of Horticulture and Environmental Stewardship at Mountaintop Arboretum. And joining us now is Mark Wolf. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. Wanted to talk to you a little bit about your keynote address, Catskills Native Plants, an Inspiration for Design at Mountaintop Arboretum. But before we talk a little bit about the address, tell folks about Mountaintop Arboretum who may not know about this unique location.
Yeah, it's really a gem up in the Catskill Mountains that a lot of people don't know about, but it's been around since 1977. And we have 200 acres that some of it is managed and some of it is gardens. So we do have, not right now because we're at 2,400 foot elevation. So our spring comes later than yours down the mountain. But we have, beautiful flowers, garden beds, trees and shrubs and herbaceous plants. We have rain gardens that we've designed and planted so that people can get inspiration for their own home plantings, too.
And it's a public garden. You're dedicated to displaying and managing native plant species of the northeastern United States. How do you go about that? How do you go about collecting, displaying, and managing all this? Sounds like a huge task.
Yeah, it's it's a pretty big task, and we have a staff of three, so we are very busy. Although in the summer fall season, we hire a couple of seasonal gardeners. We manage for invasive plants. We did a natural resources inventory in 2018 where we documented every plant species that we could find on the 200 acres. We also brought in geologists to discuss the geologic history and the glacial history, and we had scientists looking at bird populations, insect populations, amphibian populations, bat populations. So what we do is we try and manage those areas, and then in the natural areas for the health of these plant habitats. And then in the gardened areas, which we were starting to propagate plants that we collect from seed, but that's in the very early stages. But we buy plants from local native plant nurseries we order native plants at the nurseries that sell plugs online, which are the small plants. I'm sure the master gardeners know what the plugs are. And then we plant gardens that are focused on beauty and using these native plants to create habitat for the wildlife that we know uses the arboretum.
And you're the keynote address at the 2024 Garden Day called Cultivate Your Green Thumb at Cornell Cooperative Extension in Ulster County. That's Saturday from 8:30 to 4. Can you give us a little preview of your keynote and what you're going to talk about?
Sure. Well, I mean, the focus we'll get is the plants that we use. And we have some... because we know our site so well, there are plants that aren't often used in gardens. And hopefully, we and other public gardens and nurseries that are trying to promote native plants, people will start to use these more. But for instance, there's a plant called swamp candles that blooms in our hidden marsh, which is a 14-acre wetland up here in the mountains. And I'll get to the plants, but what I like to do is talk about why we use native plants. And then to talk about that, we go back to the geologic history. Why do we have the soils that we have at the Arboretum? How did they form? And then the glacial history, and what did the glaciers do to the land, when the glaciers retreated, what were the plants that came in first? And we know all this because of the studies we've done. We have a bog at the Arboretum. We've cored that, and we've looked at the blanking on when you can date the peat sample. We've carbon dated the peat samples from the peat moss going back 15,000 years.
Oh, wow.
So we know what plants came in, and we know some, and that leads us again to what plants we use today. And then, of course, there's human history that I talk about, the farming. This area of the Catskills was stripped of its hemlocks because hemlocks were used for tanning. So we talk about human disturbance of that land, and then the 50-year history of the Arboretum itself, and how it's changed over the years from originally being an arboretum that was experimenting with cold hardiness of trees from around the world. And then I'd say in the last 20 years, we've moved much more towards native plants. And that's what we're really focused on now, native plants of the Northeast. But also there are some areas of the arboretum where we only plant native plants of the Catskills. So we, you know, try and get very specific in some areas.
Well, and getting that
and that's what the talk will be about.
Yeah, and then just also getting that specific in the Catskills and native plants. You know, why is it so important to be that specific, to have these native trees and shrubs and plants in our area versus, you know, just going to the, you know, big box garden store or whatever?
Good question. Hopefully the big box garden stores will start selling more and more native plants too.
Yeah.
How I like to garden, and I think the growing interest in this is you're not only gardening for the beauty of the plant, but you're gardening for the beauty of the habitat. And when I plant plants and I know that that plant is insects, which supports bird life, and the mammals that come along with that, and the amphibians and reptiles, knowing that I'm planting and helping to support a little ecosystem on my own property or at the Arboretum, I find beauty in that. So I forget what your question was, but
well, it's really why it's so important. And you're talking about the holistic nature
right?
It's not just the plant or doing something that feels good. It's supporting the entire, you know, habitat and local wildlife in addition to plants.
And that does feel good. And I think that plants should be planted for beauty. I see native plants as very beautiful. I don't discourage people from planting non-native plants. Of course you can plant non-native. If you think a plant's beautiful, go ahead and plant it. What they've realized from research now is that if 70% of your plants on your property are native, that's enough. So if you want 30% of your plants to be non-native, if you want the roses or, you know, you want non-native hydrangeas, I'm not telling people they shouldn't do that. But what I'm encouraging people to start looking for is the beauty beyond the plant. There's a beauty in the ecosystem or the habitat that you're creating. And the activity, you know, in my garden, not only do I look at the plants, but I look at the butterflies and the moths and the dragonflies and the frogs that are coming. So that's all, to me, that's the garden, is that larger habitat.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned the Mountaintop Arboretum, you're at 2,400 feet. You're open every day of the year, though. How does that work? And especially with the nor'easter barreling down on us.
Right. Well, you know, if we can get there, we will be there. But the Arboretum will be open because we don't have a gate. So as long as you can hike in if it's not plowed, but usually we get it plowed, you know, pretty early. And even though staff may not be there, The building may be closed. The Arboretum, the 200 acres, is open. And, you know, on Thursday, it will be great for snowshoeing. You know, you won't see a lot of flowers, but you'll see the beautiful sculpture of the trees. And they'll be snowshoeing and, you know, winter hiking.
And you have tips for visiting the Arboretum at your website, mtarboretum.org. Also a list of some of your events. I know you're going to be Saturday at Ulster County with that that keynote address for the Cultivate Your Green Thumb Gardening Day. But at the Arboretum, some events coming up on April 17th, Rethinking Wild Edibles with Rob Handel. And then I think there's a couple of sold-out things coming up that folks have to get on the wait list for, forest bathing among them.
Yeah, we have people should check out our website because Jennifer Hammerline is our executive director, and she's been doing the programming. And it's really fascinating, interesting programs. We had a program last weekend on bears because bears are coming out from – I learned it's not hibernation. I think it's called estivation because they don't go into full hibernation. They sort of come in and out through the winter. We have that. We have plant design courses. We have the ones you mentioned. We just had a program about making paint pigments from the natural rock at the Arboretum. We have native tree walks. We have all sorts of programming, and we have excellent program leaders to come in. The bird walks are starting to come up in May. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. And it's worth visiting our education center is a timber frame building, and it's built from trees from our property. And we try to choose as many different trees as possible to celebrate the species of trees at the Arboretum. So we use 21 different species of trees within the timber frame of the building. And it's really a gorgeous, very special education center.
Yeah, and the website address again is mtarboretum.org. You can find out about all of those events and the center, and also how to get involved, volunteer. There's a e-newsletter. And then, of course, Mark Wolf is going to be the keynote speaker at 2024 Garden Day at the Cornell Cooperative Extension in Ulster County on Saturday. And there's more information about that at ulster.cce.cornell.edu. One other thing you can find on the website for the Arboretum, Mark, is your bio. And I just wanted to point out this great line at the end of your bio. You agree with the late, great poet Mary Oliver that, quote, "The song you heard singing in the leaf when you were a child is singing still." That's great.
I love Mary Oliver, and I love that quote because it talks about sort of what I'm talking about the whole experience of gardening. You know, there's a song in there besides just the beauty of the plants, and you heard it as a child because you were out there, and it's still singing.
Yeah. Mark Wolf is the Director of Horticulture and Environmental Stewardship at the Mountaintop Arboretum. Mark, thank you so much. Good luck with this spring snow, and we'll see you on the other side.
Great. Thanks, Tim.
All right. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Tomorrow on the show, Sullivan 180, we will have our monthly check-in with them, and we'll get more about what's going on in the community on the show. Just go to our website, wjffradio.org, if you want to hear past episodes or check out our other local programming while you're there, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year, offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank, still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hello, my name is John Gordon, and I host a music show right here on WJFF called Ramble Tamble. It airs every Thursday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. I love music, and I play all kinds of different music. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday night, 7 to 9, right here on WJFF.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather in our region today, colder with rain, high 39. Tonight, periods of snow and rain, low of 35. The rain from tomorrow morning until tomorrow evening will change to snow and accumulate 1 to 3 inches before ending Thursday afternoon. And there's a winter storm watch in effect for the northern and eastern Catskills of New York. It's also voting day in New York for the presidential primary. Polls close at 9. This is Radio Catskill.